Hello everyone, welcome back. It is the afternoon of May 3rd, 2015. It's a beautiful sunny afternoon here in Winnipeg, although it looks like the wind's coming up and we're probably going to get a bit of a rainstorm a little later on. But for now, it's a beautiful sunny afternoon. I hope things are well in your part of the world. I've had three people write in over this last month. They sent in questions, and it looks like we're probably going to focus on the subject of meditation in this response. But before we get down to that, I want to thank anyone who did send in questions or comments, words of appreciation. I want to thank those who ordered Buddescence through the website. I want to thank those who sent in donations. And as always, I want to thank Marcus Fellows for establishing this website in the first place and for continuing to post these responses each month. Again, for anyone who's new to this website, if you're finding any of the responses difficult to relate to and you're interested, then you may look up the two main talks on this website. If you go to the Listen Dropbox and scroll down to the Talks heading, you'll find the two main talks. One is titled An Overview of Spiritual Awakening, and the other is titled Acknowledging the Moment. And those two will give you the broadest overview of what I'm offering here. Everything that I offer on this website is simply for your consideration. I'm not asking you to believe it. I'm not asking you to look at life in this particular way. This is simply one particular perspective on life. If you relate to it, that's great. If you don't relate to it, that's also great. This is not the one true expression of existence. This is just one of the many mysterious expressions of existence. Before I get down to the questions that were sent in, someone wrote to tell me that they're having trouble getting hold of my books through Amazon. And Amazon is sometimes telling people that they're out of stock in my books and it will take them 2 months to get other copies, which is not true. They actually can send out a copy at any time, but they're attempting to force certain people to use them as a digital printing service. So in order to do that, anyone who's not using them as a digital printing service is kind of being put on the back burner. If Amazon is telling you that, just be patient. They will eventually send you my books. And Non-Duality Press is attempting to approach that in a different way and try to alleviate any problem there. All right, so let's get down to what's been sent in this past month. First person has written in saying, "Hi Daryl, thanks for being here for us non-duality types. Politics in the United States of America is driving me crazy. How do I apply my non-duality principles to this situation? Thanks very much for your time and consideration of this item." And this was sent in by somebody who lives in the United States. So, let's see. I can't really say to anyone how they're supposed to apply the principles of non-duality to any political situation. I mean, if we look around the world at this moment, the governments of the world are all acting in a very strange way. The world economic situation is getting very unstable. People are becoming somewhat frightened of the situation. They're becoming fearful of others in the world who may appear to be a threat of some kind. The general populations in the world are feeling somewhat overwhelmed and under a lot of pressure. People are behaving in a very protective manner. People are behaving in a very aggressive manner. And all of that is simply the natural expression of things at this time. And within that larger situation, of course, there are as well, very naturally, there are those apparent people who wish to still behave in some kind of considerate manner, some kind of sensible manner as far as they can see it. Along with those individuals who are just tired, they're just overwhelmed by the whole situation. And they've perhaps reached the end of their patience in certain situations. They've perhaps reached the end of their reasonable consideration of certain situations. And they're very naturally behaving in a much more aggressive manner. Some people are still thinking in terms of, let's all join together and handle the difficulties that are existing right now in some kind of friendly fashion. And there are those who have pretty much decided that it's every man for himself or every woman for herself. And they're just going to get what they can get and to hell with everyone else. So if we consider this situation from the aspect of non-duality, I mean, really, what does non-duality say about the event of your life? Ultimately, it's simply saying there's no way of truly saying what exactly is going on here, that ultimately it is unexplainable, and that whatever this is that's happening in this moment, in any moment, wherever, that it is simply expressing itself spontaneously, automatically. So it is the case that no matter what we look at in existence, it seems to go through some kind of wave-like motion where you have peaks and valleys. And that applies both to the wave action on an ocean, as well as human behavior within human society. We have certain periods of time where human beings seem to be very intelligent, and they seem to be very caring, and they seem to be very reasonable in general. And we have other periods of time, or let me say, as reasonable and as caring and as cohesive as they've ever demonstrated they can be. And then you have other times when human behavior is very erratic, and it seems like we're going through one of those periods. Ultimately, from this non-dual sense of things, each of us is going to behave in whatever way makes the most sense to us, and we don't ultimately get to decide what it is that's going to make the most sense to us. And actually, each of us is going to behave in whatever way we're compelled to behave, and sometimes even our own behavior won't seem to make any sense to us, but that is the way we're going to behave, because from this non-dual sense of things, everything simply occurs in whatever way it occurs. There is no self that exists apart from the event deciding how we're going to behave in this situation. So I can't really say to somebody how they're supposed to apply the non-dual principles to any particular situation. In this case, as this person's asking, how do I apply it to the politics in the United States? However, I can say with absolute certainty that you will have to be whatever expression of existence you are in any particular moment. Your particular needs, your particular interests, your particular concerns, your particular sensibilities will simply arise in whatever they arise, and they'll play out in whatever way they play out. And all of this ultimately is really simply an unexplainable occurrence, simply occurring on its own, spontaneously, automatically, organically, however you want to express that. From this non-dual perspective, it is the case that life is simply going to express itself in whatever way it expresses itself. And sometimes the expression is very, what we might call, difficult or unpleasant. And yet there's really ultimately nothing that can be done about that, because we are not ultimately in control of existence. From a non-dual perspective, we're not actually influencing it in any way at any time, because our very expression, whatever we see ourselves to be, that itself is an expression of existence. We don't create ourselves, and we don't create anything else in existence. There is simply this great, unexplainable, undivided happening, simply happening. But that doesn't mean that we will sit around doing nothing, or we'll sit around feeling that everything is okay all the time. I mean, ultimately, we may realize that the universe is simply unfolding, no doubt, as it should. However, in any particular moment, we will do whatever makes the most sense to us, following our own particular needs, interests, concerns, urges, and sensibilities. And ultimately, we don't get to decide what those are going to be or how they're going to express themselves. All right, another person has written in saying, "Hello, Daryl. I first want and do thank you for the contribution you give to those of us who come across your work. You likely will never know how far and wide your sharing adds light to the world. I especially thank you for being part of my journey. A question or two. Can a person declare oneself as awakened, or does one need another to confirm it? I sense I have awakened, but I am not currently with any group, so I have no one to talk to about it, other than people in my day-to-day life. What are your thoughts on this? How much sharing does one do? I'm guessing to share what seems right in the moment, and that sharing in a formal setting is unnecessary. I have noticed on a bunch of websites on meditation that there are hundreds of talks on various topics of meditation. Are they of value, or do they just continue to feed the idea of a separate self? Thank you for your response." Okay, so a few questions here. The last one on meditation seems to be apart from the first two. So this person asks, can a person declare oneself as awakened, or does one need another to confirm it? From what I'm offering here, it wouldn't lead to anyone declaring that they're an enlightened being or declaring that they're awakened. From what I'm presenting here, if you relate to what I'm presenting, perhaps at some point it will be realized that there really isn't any way that we can truly describe what's happening here. And other people may want to say that that's an enlightened view, but for someone who really relates to what's being presented here, the whole story of enlightenment is really just another fantasy that really, in realizing there is no way of truly saying what's occurring in this moment, all that remains is just the unexplainable happening of the moment. And so the focus is not really on descriptions. We have this vital, vibrant, unexplainable occurrence of this moment, and it's simply occurring automatically. And that sense of things doesn't really leave someone with the idea that they're an enlightened being. That would be, how would I say it? That would be off the point. Within the world of classical non-duality and the various ways that it's being expressed, a recurring point is that anyone who has this sense of existence doesn't really see themselves as an awakened being. They simply see themselves, or they feel that what actually exists in the moment is simply a vibrant, unexplainable liveliness. And there isn't any focus on defining that in any particular way. Even though what we call definitions and what we call storylines still arise, and they may be, they may seem to be of some practical use in cooking a meal or building a bridge or whatever, but this notion that one is an enlightened being and that there are ignorant beings that are unawakened, this is of no practical value within this non-dual sensibility. So this person is asking, can a person declare oneself as awakened, or does one need another to confirm it? Well, you wouldn't really need another person to confirm that you feel all of existence is a totally unexplainable happening. Either that's the sense of existence you have, or it isn't. So there isn't something there for someone else to confirm. Now, in what I'm expressing here, like I've been expressing it over and over for a number of years now, that I don't really have any, in this moment, I don't have the feeling that there's any way to really explain what's happening in this moment. Now, I have all kinds of what we might call stories, and I have what we might call practical stories for approaching certain situations in life. But in this question of what's truly happening here, to start to consider what reality is, and is it possible to describe reality, I don't have the sense that there's any real way of saying anything about the happening of this moment, anything that would be ultimately true. And whatever this is, it's simply occurring automatically. Now, I don't need anyone to confirm that. I mean, that's the sense I have of existence. That sense presented itself at a certain point, and it seems to be maintaining itself, even though the emphasis on certain points seem to change day to day. In general, the sense is that there's no true way of saying what's actually going on in this moment, and whatever this is, it's simply happening all on its own. It's happening automatically. Now, as Einstein might say, or Stephen Hawking might say, or as Nikola Tesla might say, might have said, that all of existence is simply a machine, and human beings aren't really separate from that machine of existence. This person who's written in goes on to ask, how much sharing does one do? By that, I have the feeling he's asking how much sharing should one do regarding this perspective. He goes on to say, I'm guessing to share what seems right in the moment. And yes, that's what I would say. I mean, if you really relate to this perspective, you will respond, you will apparently respond to any particular situation in any particular moment in whatever way seems appropriate for you. Again, as I stated earlier, you will be the expression of nature that's simply occurring in any particular moment. There isn't anybody who exists apart from that expression of existence that gets to decide how existence is going to express itself. We are the dance of existence. You know, there is no self of any kind that exists apart from this totally unexplainable happening. The unexplainable happening of this moment. He goes on to say that he feels that sharing in any formal setting is unnecessary. And yes, like for anyone who's listening to this, like I didn't set out for this particular situation to exist. I was living here in Winnipeg, or so my story goes anyway. I was living here in Winnipeg. I had a certain sense of existence. I began expressing that to close friends who then felt that that was, for them, a very clear sense of existence. And then one friend in particular asked me to present it in her yoga studio. And I mean, I felt, at that time, I felt uneasy expressing this. I mean, that it just seemed that no one would really be interested in this. And then it turned out that a number of people were interested in it. And it's been going on for a number of years now. And somebody offered this website. My friend Marcus in England offered to establish this website. And we've been offering this perspective for about 4 years now. And so people who are interested in this come to this. But really, in the big picture, we're like stamp collectors, or we're like people who like bowling, or people who like, you know, any certain thing in particular. Within the big expression of existence, there are certain apparent people who are simply expressed with this sense of existence, and they relate to this sense of existence, and for them it's the appropriate sense of existence. And so, as the old saying goes, birds of a feather flock together. And all of this is simply the movement of existence, in the same way that certain clouds gather together in the sky in a certain way at a certain time, or the seasons shift in the way that they do. From this perspective, all of it is simply the unexplainable happening of this larger dance of existence. Now, this last portion of this person's questions, he asks, or he mentions, I have noticed on a bunch of websites on meditation that there are hundreds of talks on various topics of meditations. Are they of value, or do they just continue to feed the separate self? So, now someone else, you know, the third person who wrote in this month wrote in to ask about meditation. So I'll go on to read that person's question as well. This third person wrote in to say, if you can spare some time this month, I was wondering if you could speak a little about the practice of meditation. I understand that words like method and technique do not really apply to meditation for you. Nevertheless, it would be interesting for me to learn a little bit more about your approach to it. I have heard you say that the best form of meditation is when you literally do absolutely nothing. So when I am sitting there meditating in a darkened room in my comfortable chair and those inevitable thoughts enter the mind, the idea is to simply observe or witness those thoughts without identifying or attaching to them and following their storyline. And then the more one does this, the more the mental chitter-chatter decreases and dissipates until we eventually achieve a deep state of relaxation and inner peace. But isn't this observing and witnessing of thought also a doing or an action of sorts, when the purpose is not to do or act on anything at all? Perhaps witnessing or awaring, as the renowned physicist and philosopher Peter Russell has coined the term, is subtly distinct from observing, in that the former is not actually an action. Your views on all of this would be of genuine interest to me. Many thanks and all good wishes. And then he went on to say, do you like to sit quietly on a regular basis, and what effects does it offer to you, if anything at all? I do understand that it's different for each one of us, but I would like to know your approach to it. Thanks, as always, for such fascinating question and answers, and I look forward to the monthly. All right. So let me see if I can just generally sum up these questions. The one person was asking if the various talks on types of meditations are of any value, or do they just continue to feed the separate self? And what exactly is my approach to meditation? And as this person has described my approach as being an observing meditation, but that's actually not the case. So let's get into this topic of meditation. It seems to be quite complex in that pretty much everybody has a different idea of what the word meditation refers to. And if we look at the various traditions that have mentioned meditation, they all seem to have a different idea of what that meditation is, or on the surface, it seems as though they have a different idea of what meditation is. And if we look at the various people talking about meditation around the world, it seems on the surface as though they're talking about different things. So I can give you my sense of all of it. Who knows if you'll relate to it or not. But it is the case that in my apparent journey, I mean, even though all the storylines about existence are really ultimately a fantasy, we all do have storylines, and in my particular storyline, it is the case that I had a great interest in meditation and in exploring the topic of meditation. I spent 17 years from the age of 14 on, basically exploring various meditations on my own from many different traditions. I would spend 1 to 3 hours a day exploring different techniques and different methods. And eventually, the basic Buddhist practice of bare awareness in the moment, what is commonly known as mindfulness, became of great interest to me, and I both studied with a very well-known teacher in Southern California, a woman named Ruth Dennison, for about 9 years or 10 years, and then I went on to ordain as an Orthodox Buddhist monk in a meditation tradition that came out of the forests of northern Thailand. Although I didn't go to Thailand, I went to England, where a teaching monk by the name of Sumedho, Ajahn Sumedho, was living. And he was well known as a meditation monk. So, just in general, there are a lot of different practices and methods and techniques that are pointed to with the word meditation. So, people talk about meditation and they talk about holding certain images in their minds. They talk about meditation and they talk about using certain aphorisms or certain mental statements that you might hold in your mind, certain topics, intellectual topics that you might hold in your mind. People talk about meditation and they're talking about counting the breath. People talk about meditation and they're talking about trying to generate body heat or certain energetic situations. People talk about meditation and they talk about practicing awareness. They talk about developing awareness, developing their ability to be aware of the moment, to be constantly aware of the moment. People talk about meditation and they think in terms of concentration. There are certain people who are very skilled, apparently, with concentration. So when they go on a retreat, they may put themselves in a situation where at some point all of their thought may fall away for short periods of time or for a somewhat longer period of time. It varies from person to person. As I've attempted to point to over the years, each and every apparent human being is a unique expression, is really different from every other human being. So in the area of concentration, not everybody apparently has what one would say is a skill with concentration. You have other people talking about meditation, and they're talking about something called mindfulness, vipassana, and they won't be interested in levels of concentration. And then within the traditions that you have regarding awareness practices, you have different ways of that people point to this or talk about this. So even within the realms of Buddhism, you have Zen Buddhism, which talks about meditation as just sitting. You have Orthodox Theravada Buddhism, which is talking about vipassana practice, mindfulness practice. You have certain Chinese Buddhisms that are using various puzzles to attempt to bring thought to a standstill. You have koan practice, which then went on to be transferred to Japan. Within the Tibetan Buddhisms that exist, you have a number of different methods and techniques, many, many different methods and techniques, some of them focusing on concentration and some of them focusing on simple considerations of what you might call wisdom teachings. And all of this stuff gets pointed to with the word meditation. So, I mean, all I can do, I can't tell you what anybody else is actually meaning by meditation or what they've found meditation to be good for or not. So all I can do is express my own experience within this area. So, okay, let's start with meditation on mental objects. So for years I was doing meditations where I was holding a three-dimensional image in my mind and I would turn it mentally to look at it from many different sides. Now, there were all kinds of interesting experiences I would have in relation to concentration. There would be moments that thought would fall away, but really what would happen more than anything else is just I would become very skilled at holding the image of a three-dimensional object in the mind to simply consider that image from a number of different vantage points. And ultimately, it didn't feel like that was leading to any kind of great revelation about existence. There were moments that felt very free because I would get very concentrated on that mental image and all the thoughts would fall away. But when I would end that period of holding that image in the mind, all the thoughts would come rushing back. And I was stuck in my old storylines just as much as I always was. Let's see. There were meditations on certain aphorisms. Now, certain statements about life. You know, there was one point where I was doing, exploring psycho-cybernetics, where you would have this statement about, every day in every way I'm getting better and better. And you would hold that statement in your mind for a very long period of time, or you would repeat it on a daily basis. And basically what I found from that was even on the days that I felt like crap, I would be saying, every day in every way I'm getting better and better. And after a few months of that, it just seemed totally absurd because I wasn't getting better and better. I didn't feel that life was getting better and better. It just seemed like I was saying something stupid and nothing much was coming from it. So again, this is just from my experience. Like, I'm not saying somebody else wouldn't experience something else from that kind of a practice or a technique. For a while, I was doing Sufi meditation practices, concentration practices that had to do with counting. I would be touching the tips of my fingers to my thumb, and I would be counting in a certain way. I would be counting up to from 1 to the number 10, and each time I said a certain number, I would touch one of my fingertips to my thumb, and then I would switch to another fingertip, and so on. And I would count from 1 to 10, then I would count from 10 back to 2, and then up to 11, 11 back to 3, 3 up to 12, 12 back to 4, 4 up to 13, and I would just keep going as long as I could. And then added to that, I would be tapping my feet to a certain rhythm, and I would be bobbing my head twice to the left, twice to the front, and twice to the right, and the whole time attempting to handle all of this activity and just keep it going. So it's a bit like patting your head and rubbing your tummy at the same time. It's just a little more complex, and you try to keep it going for a long period of time. What did I get from that? I got extremely concentrated so that all thoughts would be pushed away. I would become very focused on that actual practice. And when I left it and went to do something else, it seemed like my mind was just very clear. But For a short time, it seemed like it was very clear. It didn't seem to sweep away any underlying sense of angst that I had over life. It didn't give me any different relationship to thought, to my storylines. But it was an interesting practice. Probably the very first thing I did apparently do as far as meditation went was just intuitively on my own. Before I read anything about meditation techniques or methods, I went into the basement of our house, our family house where I grew up. We had a family room. I could close the door, turn out the lights, and no natural light would get into the room. So I would block any light getting in through the bottom of the door. And so the room was very dark, and I would lie down, and I would pass my attention. I was compelled. I had this feeling intuitively that there was some kind of freedom in connecting with the actual physical sensations of the moment rather than being focused on thought. So I would pass my attention through my body from the soles of my feet up to the top of my head and back down again. And simply, you know, if I got distracted by thought, I would return my attention to the actual physical sensations of the moment. And in that, I would experience really open states, feelings of great spaciousness, where no thought would be present. And then when thought did come back, the question was, what's that? Like, and I would feel very warm, and I would feel as though life made total sense to me, but I had no, I didn't know what that was about, and I couldn't get that open state to stay. I could put myself in certain situations, and that feeling of openness would come, and the falling away of thought would come, but I couldn't get that state to stay. It felt wonderful, but the moment there was the feeling that it was wonderful, the focus went back on thought, and it seemed like I no longer had that spaciousness, and I was once again focused on my stories, which once again contained all of my stories of angst and questions about life, confusions about life. So again, that was a wonderful thing to be doing. It was a bit like going to the pub and getting drunk, but it didn't stay. So it was pleasant while it happened. It didn't really stay, and it didn't really seem to alter my sense of existence in any way, in any big way. Now, for me, in my apparent journey, it was those awareness practices. I did a lot of the visualization practices and the aphorisms, you know, saying good things in order to generate good mind states. Metta meditation is another form of those, using those aphorisms where you're wishing everybody well. And you can get really blissed out with these feelings of love for the world. I did these various concentration practices, whether it was doing Sufi practices or doing counting practices where you count the breath from 1 to 10 and then you start over again. Any number of concentration practices. Concentration on sound. I would concentrate on the what we call the sound of silence, or what yoga traditions refer to as the nada, which is that kind of high-pitched electrical sound that people will often hear when they're in situations of quiet. So other groups will refer to it as the sound of silence, because when the thoughts aren't very active and the focus isn't on thought and you're in a quiet place so that no other sound is taking prominence, this high-pitched electrical sound will often be the main sound that many people hear. So it's often referred to as the sound of silence. So I would do all of those kinds of practices, but also at the same time, I was doing what were known as basic awareness practices, simply opening up to the happening of the moment. But in all of that, there was the sense that I was developing my awareness, that I was opening awareness to the happening of the moment. And there were many, many things that I apparently learned in that. You know, it became more and more obvious that everything in life was changing. It became very, very obvious that in the times that I was attempting to control the situation, that seemed to be filled with all kinds of misery. And even though, you know, I could be approaching life in a very practical way and doing something very practical, there would be perhaps an overwhelming urge to have real control over the entire situation. And not having control over the entire situation made me feel terrible. There was a certain amount of suffering in that, wanting control but not having control. So then in situations where I was just simply meditating and opening up to the happening of the moment without any kind of grasping, that obviously felt quite free. So there were all kinds of things to be learnt in that way, but ultimately it did feel as though I was on an endless journey to improve myself, that I was on an endless journey to cultivate awareness, to get to the point where I wouldn't be caught up in thought ever, where I would be constantly focused on just the happening of the moment. I wouldn't be judging it. I wouldn't be wanting anything in particular. And I would be free of all the agonies of life, free of all the grief, free of all the wanting. So basically in studying with different groups, studying these awareness practices, this is the general attitude that basically I was asked to cultivate. Now, in that situation, everybody would say that I was very skilled with concentration. I could monitor the happening of the moment in incredible detail. If I went on a long retreat, thought would fall away at some point. There would just be the big, blissful happening of the moment. And that would feel wonderful. But along the way, again, those wonderful, blissful moments would present themselves over and over again, but none of them would stay. And so there was a frustration. It felt like I wasn't somehow getting something, that somehow I wasn't getting to this place of perfection. And more than that, I began to question, like I would find myself sitting there simply observing the moment, but then in the background I could kind of feel this desire for the whole thing to arrive someplace. Like that somehow I wanted the whole thing just to come to a certain place and end. To arrive at some realization and just have the whole thing come to completion and come to an end. It just, you know, it went on for so long. It went on from about age 30 till about into my mid 40s, that it felt like I was searching for something in particular. Even though along the way, I could see that life was this moving, shifting, dancing event, and that I couldn't really say what anything was, there was still somehow this subtle sense of me being in charge of it and me wanting to eventually get to the end of this path. So, even in that, the sense of being separate from existence disappeared, but somehow there was still a sense that I was somehow directing my life, which is very odd. I mean, there's no explanation for that whatsoever. I can remember very clearly there was an evening when I was married. I was living in Oakland, California. We had a nice apartment overlooking a lake. Late one night, I was sitting quietly. I became curious about awareness itself. I was thinking, well, okay, if I'm sitting here being aware of things like body sensations, like where is the awareness? Like where is this awareness I think that I am? Like, so I carefully noted the feeling of pressure when I was sitting, the pressure of my supposed body on the chair. And so I noticed that, and then mentally I tried to back up. I was thinking, like, so where's this awareness? And at a certain point I realized it became very obvious to me, or it just became very obvious that that sensation of pressure was what I called awareness. There wasn't anything separate from it being aware of it. It was this sensation of pressure making itself obvious. That's what I called awareness. And the feeling that something was happening in the moment, that was my basic sense of awareness. There wasn't anything apart from it being aware of it. It was simply this happening that made itself obvious. That's what I called awareness. I didn't really know what it was, but that was what I called awareness, and it became very obvious. It became just the fact that there wasn't any awareness separate from it being aware of it. It was simply the happening of the moment making itself obvious. That's what I called awareness. Now, even though in that the whole sense of being separate from existence itself started to melt away, for a number of years following, there was still the sense that somehow there was a me in me kind of directing all of this. Until at a certain point, I had left the monastery. I'd done a full 6 years of training as a Buddhist monk in an Orthodox meditation tradition. I had done a 10-year apprenticeship with Ruth Dennison in an unorthodox situation. I had spent 17 years on my own, simply exploring any techniques and methods that I could run across. When I started out, there were hardly any books on this subject. By the time I was finished, everybody was writing a book on this stuff, and it was all just totally confusing. So at a certain point after, as I said, it lasted from very consciously, this kind of exploration, it lasted from the time I was about 14 years old until the time that I was into my mid-40s. By that time, I walked away from everything. I just returned to the area that I'd grown up in here in Manitoba. And I just wanted to be as far away from any kind of groups, any kind of formal meditation situation as I could possibly be. So, in those years of doing these formal meditation practices, I had experienced all kinds of odd states of mind, all of which were passing. I'd experienced moments of incredible peace. I'd experienced periods of time where there was no thought. I experienced energy releases, which most people refer to as the release of a Shakti in your nervous system. I experienced those releases as being somewhat blissful, and in other situations those releases were so strong that they were very disorienting, and my whole realm of thought would be disoriented for very long periods of time. And I mean very long periods of time, like 2 or 3 years in certain situations. I experienced a certain sensitivity, it seemed, to other people around me. I seemed to be aware of what they were thinking in certain situations, but all of these were just passing experiences. None of them stayed, and none of them gave me the feeling of being somehow complete or fulfilled in any way whatsoever. All of it was just very frustrating. And I had experienced the meditation practice that I was most drawn to, what we call, you know, basic awareness practices, things like Zen sitting or Theravada Vipassana or mindfulness practice. I'd experienced certain Western psychological approaches to that. I'd experienced unorthodox situations where I was studying with Ruth Dennison, a very intuitive person with regard to meditation, someone who could really make a very wonderful invitation to everyone to acknowledge the happening of the moment. I had experienced a very highly orthodox approach to all of this with living in a meditation monastery for 6 years. I ended up a Buddhist meditation teacher in that situation. I was a teaching monk. All of which was wonderful, and all of which seemed to offer all kinds of amazing learning situations and various experiences. But none of that left me feeling as though I had found what I was searching for. None of that left me with the feeling that I was fulfilled in some way. It was all a very interesting journey. I had met Robert Adams along the way, and we had discussed certain things, and I realized that, you know, in some way I saw the world the way some of these great non-dual teachers, Advaita teachers, were expressing their perspective of existence. And I had gone to see Jiddu Krishnamurti a number of times, both in San Francisco, when I was living in San Francisco. I saw him also in Ojai, in the Oak Grove, when he was about 90. Again, all of which was a wonderful exploration. There were all kinds of interesting things that occurred, all kinds of interesting realizations that occurred, but none of that left me feeling as though I had come to some kind of fulfillment that I was looking for. So it wasn't until I had walked away from all of that, I just wanted to be as far away from any kind of spiritual group as I could possibly be. I wanted to be as far away from any kind of method or technique for observing life as I could possibly be. And I returned to Manitoba in Canada. I got myself a job. I had a girlfriend at the time, and I just, for about a year and a half, I didn't look at anything that anybody would consider spiritual. I was just totally worn out. I just wanted nothing to do with questions about existence or anybody's philosophy. All I wanted to do was just do a simple job, you know, a manual labor job, and just let the rest of the world go by. But after about a year and a half, my natural interest in these things returned. And so I just began reading all kinds of general things. And at a certain point, I ran across a book by Ramesh Balsekar. And if I remember correctly, it was titled Explorations into the Eternal. And I read this thing a few times. It seemed like there was something in it that was interesting, but I couldn't quite figure out what it was. Somehow it wasn't very clear as to what was so fascinating about it. And I started reading it a fourth time, and I realized what it was generally saying. So one night I was lying in bed with my girlfriend, I woke up very early. I picked up this book. I started reading it. I can't even remember what part of the book it was in, but generally there was just a statement that was saying nobody has the experience of directing their own life, that if you look at your own experience, you will not find any experience that supports the idea that you're directing your own life. Now, I can't remember if that was one particular sentence or whether that was just the general gist of this book. Anyway, I do remember I got halfway through a certain sentence. I was reading it and my eyes left the page and the thought came, you have never done anything in your life. And in that moment, I tried to find some actual memory of an experience where I was directing my life, where I actually created the urge to explore something, where I actually created my interest in something. And I couldn't find any example of me creating my needs or my interests or my concerns or my urges. They all just came up as part of life. And then I also remember that when I was in my 20s and people were asking me to settle down and focus on a career and decide what I was going to do with my life, that question gave me a lot of trouble because I could not figure out how was I going to decide to direct my life when I didn't create my interests, when I didn't create my needs, when I didn't create my concerns. I could not figure out, like, how would I be deciding if all of those things would have to be the motivating factors for me deciding something? However, in my 20s, I didn't stay focused on that. I just seemed to be confused about it. However, at this point in my mid-40s, when I was reading this book by Ramesh Balsekar, and it said, no one has an experience of directing their own life, the more I considered that, the more I considered all of my memories about my life and how it was that I got into certain things, how it was that certain urges arose to explore certain aspects of life, it became very obvious that I wasn't creating those. And therefore, I didn't create any of my actions that followed those urges. All of that was the expression of the universe. It was the expression of nature. And at first, that was very confusing. At first, I thought I had really gone crazy. When I was in the monastery, people were telling me things like, don't ever question the idea of free will. When I was living in California and listening to some of the Buddhist teachings, a lot of people were saying, don't ever question the idea of free will. And there I was at a certain point in my life where I couldn't see any example anywhere of free will. I couldn't see any example of me creating myself or creating my inclinations to go in any particular direction in life. However, as apparent time went by, I realized that this was just really a very simple assessment of what my actual experience of life is, the only sense of life that I actually have. So it wasn't some kind of craziness. It was a really simple acknowledgement of what my experience had been and is of life presenting itself. And again, as apparent time went by, this basically was the end of the search. That all of my other sense of existence, the sense that existence was this great mysterious movement, the sense that I didn't exist as anything apart from that, was now somehow complete in that it was obvious that I hadn't directed any of existence, that I wasn't directing any of existence. I'm not directing it now. The happening of this moment is happening in whatever way it's happening. You know, the supposed process that I am is just happening. I don't make it happen. It just happens. The particular apparent needs, the particular apparent concerns, the particular loves, the particular urges that present themselves just present themselves. Like, I don't make them happen, and I don't decide which one is going to be strongest. You know, I might be interested in watching a movie until an urge to get some food comes up, and I don't decide which urge is going to be strongest, watching the movie or getting food. It's like one of them ends up stronger than the other one. Like being aggravated by a particular situation in life, what seems to be, you know, me being aggravated by a particular situation in life, and the urge to be patient with that situation, along with the urge to just throw my arms up and say, to hell with this, those urges just come up. The urge to be patient, the aggravation. These things simply present themselves, and I don't get to decide which one's stronger. Like, in certain situations, I find myself being incredibly patient. In other situations, it just seems like being patient is a totally ridiculous thing to be doing in that situation. And so, I don't have a sense of being patient. And all of it's fine, because I'm not ultimately deciding what it's going to be. I mean, I do have an inclination to be patient with certain situations in life. And I didn't create that inclination. And there are certain situations where it makes total sense to be endlessly patient. But then there are other situations where my inclination is to be patient, and after a while it just seems to be a totally ridiculous situation, me being patient with that situation. So I either say something to somebody that isn't so pleasant, or I walk away from the situation. Because in my whole sense of existence, it doesn't make sense to sit there being patient. Now, it's also the case that there are situations where my inclination is to be patient with a situation, and I just don't have the ability to be patient with it. And there's nothing I can do about that. None of it is my choice. Now, again, this really didn't come from some deep concentrated state, this sense of existence, that all of existence was just presenting itself. It seemed to come from a very simple acknowledgement that whatever I feel I am, I don't create that. I don't create any of it. It just presents itself. And that was based on just my very general experience of life, my only experience of life. Again, a number of other feelings about life came up in the years that I was supposedly very concentrated in meditation. So, but even those were just general acknowledgments. It wasn't something coming from some deep state of concentration where there was no thought. It came from a more general acknowledgement of the movement of life. So one of the things that became obvious over the years was that I was always trying to find one specific experience in life to make me feel better, but all the specific experiences in life moved on. They didn't stay. So no matter how much I wanted to create a bliss-filled, concentrated state, that wasn't possible. And then later it became obvious that I wasn't even the one wanting. Like, I wasn't creating the desire to have a bliss-filled, concentrated state. There was just this compulsion to explore bliss-filled, concentrated states. I wasn't creating that compulsion. That's just the way life was expressing itself. The fact that my storylines weren't true, that became more obvious when I actually, instead of getting concentrated and not having thought, I began to just acknowledge what thought was giving me. So it was obvious that I came out of the womb, I didn't have a storyline, so where did this storyline come from, and what was this storyline actually giving me? And the more I examined that, I realized, well, wait a minute. In this apparent happening of the moment, I'm getting the storyline from someone else. Somebody's telling me to call different forms by different names. But when I call them that, I don't really end up knowing what they actually are. The word just points to that apparent form, and it was obvious that those forms were changing. So in that very simple consideration of what my only experience of stories actually was and what they meant to me, it became obvious that those storylines can't really be telling me what's going on here, because they're just sounds that ultimately point to forms that actually don't really have a form, because they're changing. So my interest in trying to define life in terms of reality just fell away. The storylines are there. If I need to read a cookbook to make a meal, or I need to read a movie schedule in order to find out what movie is playing at a certain theater, those stories are there and they work just fine. But I don't have any question about what's life all about anymore, because I don't have a story that can tell me what that is. I don't have any way of saying what life is all about. So, you know, all the way along, I had heard stories about something called awakening. I'd heard stories about spiritual liberation. I'd heard stories about awakened beings. But the more I really considered just these very general points about existence, the more I realized that all of those stories were just fantasies too. I mean, it's so at this point, right now, the happening of this moment, there's, for me, there's no way of saying what this is. And when I say for me, the word just points to an unexplainable happening. Like, I'm an unexplainable happening too. What seems to be outside the body is an unexplainable happening. What seems to be inside the body is an unexplainable happening. Actually, this idea that there's an outside and an inside is just an unexplainable thing too. It's just like, it's not an outside and an inside. Right now it's just one big happening. There's no way for me to say what that is. And what's really wild about it is that it's all just happening the way it happens. Like, I don't have to be concerned about what my thought is going to be 2 minutes from now, or what my feelings are going to be an hour from now, or how I should relate to something, because I haven't been doing any of it all along. It's just happening the way it happens. Now, weirdly enough, it doesn't feel like I'm being pushed around by some greater power. It doesn't feel like I'm kind of imprisoned by some greater power that's in charge of me. Basically, the feeling is that I don't know what any of this is. Whatever it is just expressing itself with total freedom. I am that totally free expression. But again, my focus isn't on those words. This happening of this moment is just a totally spontaneous vibrancy that's occurring, and that's all it is. There, I can't find a little something that's being pushed around by it. There is only the dance of this unexplainable vibrancy. It's just expressing itself freely in whatever way it does. And sometimes, you know, what's being expressed is very painful. It seems to be very confusing, but I don't really know what that is either. Other times it's very blissful, it's very happy. Sometimes I feel like sitting quietly. Sometimes I don't want to sit quietly. In general, if we were to focus on the story of my personality, I have an urge to sit quietly a lot of the time. Like in the evenings, I sit quietly at the end of the day. It's a very enjoyable thing for me to turn out the lights in my apartment and just sit quietly. Now, in that sitting, I'm not trying to practice awareness. I don't even think there is anything called awareness. There's just the vibrant, pulsing event of this moment, and there's the happening that we call thoughts coming and going, but I don't really have any interest in that. That's a totally unexplainable happening, and those apparent storylines just aren't necessary in that moment. I don't need to use them, so I don't even need to be interested in them. They're just a totally unexplainable happening, the way the breath is a totally unexplainable happening, coming and going, the way sound is a totally unexplainable happening, coming and going. Thoughts are just like clouds passing through the sky, or they're like little puffs of smoke, but they don't mean anything. What's more amazing is just this vibrant dynamic of the moment. Now, I'm not asking anybody to see life in that way. I'm not saying that that's awakening. I'm not saying that that's what it means to be an awakened being, because all of those stories are ridiculous to me. All of the ideologies are just painful. Like they're just in contradiction to the flow of life. All of this judgment about some people being awakened and some people being ignorant and some people being good and some people being bad, I mean, it's not ultimately true. I mean, on a certain level, it seems like I acknowledge that somebody's dangerous or they're not dangerous, but I don't see somebody as being intrinsically bad. They're simply an expression of existence, like everything else is intrinsically an expression of existence. And I don't really know what this is. To call it existence, I don't even know what that means. It's just this happening of the moment. And even that is saying too much. On a day-to-day basis, all the apparent storylines are still there. I'm not interested in some kind of moral judgment on people. I'm more interested in just the practicality of living. And in a certain apparent situation, the focus seems to go on just living in some kind of practical way, but I'm not even deciding that. Like all of this just presents itself in that way. So, some of these questions about meditation, you know, the question about is meditation helpful or not helpful, seems to be beside the point. Some people are going to be drawn to meditation, some people aren't. It doesn't really matter what anybody says about it. Some people are going to be drawn to it, some people aren't. In general, if somebody is drawn to meditation, you know, what kind of meditation are you going to be drawn to? Are you going to be drawn to this supposed awareness meditation? Well, if you're drawn to that awareness meditation and you sit quietly with whatever life is presenting, then there are all kinds of interesting things that are going to present themselves, and it's going to feel like you're learning all kinds of things. Is that going to leave you feeling ultimately free? Well, if you are sitting there thinking that you're somebody in charge, that you're somebody directing your learning, you're somebody directing your expression in life, then that's not really what classical non-duality is trying to point out. Now, big deal. I mean, so what? I mean, all of the expressions of existence are the appropriate expression of existence in any moment. Maybe you'll be expressed with a similar sense of existence to the one that I'm expressing right here, right now. Maybe you won't. Either way is fine. Like, ultimately, what this is pointing to is that this is just life expressing itself, or the universe expressing itself. And again, universe just simply means undivided turning. So there, it's just this mysterious functioning, this mysterious happening, presenting itself, and all of its expressions are the appropriate expression. So for one person who's drawn to this sense of existence, this is the sense of existence that will make them feel most happy. It still won't give you endless bliss, and it's not going to give you an endlessly pleasant life. Your life can still be very difficult, even with this sense of it. However, for another person, maybe the most natural way that they're expressed is with the notion that they're in charge of their life. And having that notion and working with that idea is going to make them the happiest that they can be. And that also is not going to give them an endlessly pleasant life, and it's not going to give them an endlessly easy life. In either case, the person who feels that they're in charge of their life, or the person who feels that there is simply this totally unexplainable happening, from this perspective, both of these are the natural expression of whatever this is. There's nothing wrong with any of it. So after having said all of that, let's get back to these three basic questions, or the few basic questions that these people sent in about meditation. So one person is saying, are any of these hundreds of talks on various topics of meditation, are they of value, or do they just continue to feed the separate self? Well, I don't know how you're ultimately going to be expressed in life. I don't know how life is going to be expressing you. So it may be that meditation is going to be something that you will apparently want to explore, or maybe it won't be. If you explore it, there are going to be all kinds of interesting apparent learning situations in that situation, and maybe the whole thing will present itself ultimately as a great mysterious happening, simply happening on its own. Or maybe it's the case that you won't be drawn to meditation, but you still have an interest in exploring life in some other ways, and ultimately you'll end up with the feeling that it's all a totally unexplainable happening, simply happening. I guess the key point is that if you're going to be drawn to what's classically known as a non-dual perspective, it has nothing to do with your doing. Life is going to present you with that perspective, or it's not ultimately going to present you with that perspective. And whether it's going to arise in a situation of you practicing meditation or not practicing meditation, you don't ultimately get to decide that either. You know, within the world of meditation, you have some people saying, well, you can't come to these realizations without extreme concentration. And yet, if you actually read the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha says, I have two types of awakened students. One type is capable of great concentration. And along with that, they have great insight. And so I declare them free. And then I have this other type of student that isn't capable of concentration, yet they're capable of great insight. So I declare them to be free too. From this classical non-dual sense of existence, you're not going to be deciding how your life is going to unfold, and you're not going to be deciding whether you have a non-dual sense of existence or not. And nobody else is going to decide it for you. So as I've said before, in any particular moment, you will simply have to go to the things that are of most interest to you. You will have to follow the only needs, interests, concerns, urges that present themselves. And you don't create any of those. Now, this other person has said that, he's heard me say that the best form of meditation is when you literally do absolutely nothing. Well, I've never said that's the best form of meditation. I said, in all of the traditions that I've explored, that's the most profound meditation that's offered in all of these traditions. So this person goes on to say that, he describes the process as he's sitting there and thoughts inevitably arise, and the idea is to simply observe or witness those thoughts without identifying them or attaching to them or following their storyline. And the more one does this, the more the mental chitter-chatter decreases and dissipates until a person eventually achieves a deep state of relaxation and inner peace. Well, I'm not interested in deep relaxation or inner peace. Like, when I sit quietly, I'm not letting the thoughts come and go because I want to achieve inner peace. Thoughts come and go as a portion of the mysterious dance of the moment. And there's more of an interest in acknowledging the mysterious dance of the moment simply presenting itself, and an acknowledgement that the stories are not telling me any truth about what's going on in this moment. So if I'm sitting quietly and storylines are not required, then it's just simply the acknowledgement that there's no way of saying what this happening of the moment actually is. When I'm at work and there's a job to be done, an apparent job to be done, then the focus is on the storylines a lot of the time, because even if the storylines aren't telling me what that situation actually is, the storyline is required in that situation. It just seems to be part of the situation, and the focus needs to go on the storyline. When I'm at home alone and there's no particular need to be addressed that requires thought, then there's no need to be interested in thought, because the thoughts come and go as a totally mysterious happening. And someone told me to call them thoughts. I don't know what they are. And so in those moments when I'm alone, things are quiet, nothing needs to be addressed with these so-called thoughts, then there's no need to even call them thoughts. There's no need to even be interested in that. What's more interesting is the vital, vibrant occurrence that has no particular form. This vital, vibrant, mysterious occurrence that's simply occurring all on its own. And it's more fascinating not to know what's coming next, or to realize that there's no way of saying what's coming next. There's no way of saying what this is going to present in any particular moment. Now, this person went on to ask, Do I like to sit quietly on a regular basis? Yes, I like to sit quietly on a regular basis. And what effect does that have on me? Well, I have an urge to sit quietly a lot of the time because I just find the whole happening of life to be very fascinating. And in those quiet moments, all the subtle aspects of life present themselves. You know, in the middle of the day, when someone is apparently making a demand on me to get a certain job done, and there's a fair bit of pressure to get that job done, the subtle aspects of the moment don't often make themselves obvious. At home, when I'm alone and things are quiet, if I simply, you know, it's not required that I get into a storyline, and it's not required that I address any particular need or interest or concern, then, before I go to bed, I just enjoy sitting quietly, and in that, the flow of life, the dynamic, the vital, vibrant functioning, this mysterious, unexplainable functioning just presents itself. And it presents itself in a very, a feeling of fullness somehow. Now, it's not always pleasant. Sometimes the thoughts are very forceful and they grab the apparent attention. Sometimes there's a particular concern that forces itself forward and it can't be addressed in that moment, but the world of thought still pushes itself forward with that concern. I never know what's going to present itself. I remember Ajahn Sumedho one morning coming into the meditation hall, and we sat in the morning meditation in the monastery, and then just as he was getting up, he sat back and he said, you'd think after 23 years of just sitting quietly, the mind would be reasonably quiet. But it isn't. And that's the fact. Like, you never know how the moment is going to present itself. So, however, even if there are particular concerns in any particular moment, in the evening when I'm tired and there's no need to be focused on thought, then it's just a very pleasant thing to just sit and let life present whatever it's going to present. There's no need for me to be concerned about any of it. And that's the case all the time, whether I'm at work or at home or in a situation with my family or alone. There's no need to be concerned about any of it because it's all simply going to unfold in whatever way it unfolds. And part of that unfolding is that it just feels pleasant to sit quietly. For other people, it's not so pleasant to sit quietly. They find that they feel free and relaxed if they're out going for a walk or going for a run or whatever. Life will express itself in whatever way it expresses itself. Nobody else has to enjoy sitting quietly. I mean, from my perspective, I'm not saying anybody else has to enjoy sitting quietly. You will be whatever expression you are. And within the world of apparent form and within the world of storylines, there are going to be other people who enjoy sitting quietly. Now, some of those people will enjoy sitting quietly because they have the feeling they're cultivating awareness. Other people will enjoy sitting quietly and they won't have the feeling they're cultivating awareness. Again, no one gets to decide what their expression is going to be. my whole sense of existence is that we don't get to decide what our expression is going to be any more than any snowflake gets to decide what its expression is going to be, or any more than a tomato plant is going to decide what its expression is going to be, or any more than a squirrel is going to decide what its expression is going to be. All of it is the spontaneous, organic, automatic dance. Just this vibrant, vital, unexplainable occurrence that we call the happening of this moment. The buzz and tingle, the pulsing, the waving, the warming, cooling, lightening, darkening, tightening, loosening, luminous, whatever this is. I mean, all these words just point to something that can't be explained in any way whatsoever. So I thought I would read quotations from a few people just to wind this up. You don't have to agree with any of this. But here's some quotations from Einstein. Scientific research is based on the idea that everything that takes place is determined by the laws of nature, and this therefore holds for the action of people. Everything is determined. It is determined for the insect as well as for the star, human beings, vegetables, or cosmic dust. We all dance to a mysterious tune. Human beings in their thinking, feeling, and acting are not free, but are as causally bound as the stars in their motion. Everybody acts not only under external compulsion, but also in accordance with an inner necessity. In Schopenhauer's words, a man can do what he wants, but he cannot will what he's going to want. So then, that was Einstein. I have a statement here by Stephen Hawking. Our understanding of the molecular basis of biology shows that biological processes are governed by the laws of physics and chemistry, and therefore are as determined as the orbits of the planets. It seems we are no more than biological machines, and free will is just an illusion. And the last quotation is from Nikola Tesla. To me, the universe is simply a great machine which never came into being and never will end. The human being is no exception to the natural order. Man, like the universe, is a machine. Now, I know a lot of you don't like the idea of determinism, and I know a lot of you don't like this reference to machines. I have great fun with them. Although I don't see life exactly this way, because it's not a situation of life being a machine the way we would normally think of machines. Life is in some way some creative process, some vibrant, unexplainable happening that never expresses itself the same way twice. And it's not a situation of someone being pushed around by that. We are a portion of this unexplainable happening. Everything that we think we are is simply a portion of this great mysterious dance of existence. It's not a situation that a star is being pushed around by some other portion of the universe. A star is a portion of the mysterious dance of the universe. The star itself is a wild, free, unexplainable expression. So everything we are is a totally wild, exotic, free expression of whatever this is. It's within the world of apparent form. Our particular expression is unique. It's different in some way from all the other expressions. It's exotic in some way. All of it is a totally unexplainable, vital, vibrant happening. Just what we would call the happening of this moment, simply happening the way it happens. That's not a situation of us being pushed around by the universe. We are this unexplainable, vibrant, vital happening. There's no explanation for us either. Ultimately, you know, within the world of apparent form, we can talk about things being subject to the laws of nature or the laws of cause and effect. But when we acknowledge this totally unformed, when we acknowledge this, the fact that everything is changing, every apparent form that we know of is changing, then we come to this formless dance. Ultimately, this vital, vibrant happening that has no form. Then we're not left with some form being pushed around by the universe. We're left with the fact that the universe itself is a vital, vibrant, unformed happening. And we don't exist as anything apart from that. We also are the vital, vibrant, unformed happening. Unexplainable happening. Simply happening. It seems like the only real difficulty is that there's this urge to think that we know what it is, and in that, we're just filled with so much judgment that it shouldn't be what it is, that we shouldn't be what we are. And from this non-dual acknowledgement, it's simply a return to acknowledging the unexplainable, the unformed. And these words simply point to this happening. Like right now, if I ask you, what is there when there is no thinking? If you think that question, at the end of the question, for a moment, there isn't what we would call thought, but there isn't a nothingness. And thought will come back as a portion of that, whatever that is, when we think the question, what is there when there's no thinking, that vital, vibrant happening, thought will come back at some point as an expression of that vibrant happening. Anyway, that's all that's coming up in response to what was sent in. As I stated at the beginning of this, I'm not asking anybody else to have this sense of existence. I'm simply offering this perspective on existence. If you relate to it, that's great. If you don't relate to it, that's great. Whatever I'm offering has to be related to your actual experience. So, until next time, I hope life offers you only good things. However, I know it's going to offer a mixed bag of things. Till next time, take care. Bye.